first, we had that tariff delay for some list four goods, at least. Then we had a handful of diverging earnings reports. And then we had those really strong retail sales numbers. Still, the ETF that tracks retail down big time, about 8% for the week.
Walmart announced, others announced. We had some tremendous numbers come out today, which I'm sure you saw. So we're very happy about that. We're doing very well. The economy is incredible. The consumer, probably above all else, the consumer is doing incredibly.
It's a huge week for the consumer. With trade tensions heating up, the consumer could get crunched.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, trade tensions. One day you have a presidential tweet sending market prices higher, but then a drop in bond yields has the markets worried about a possible recession. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up, Art Hill will be joining us from Stock Charts, and listen to what he has to say. Key sectors within the S&P are breaking down. Art is on the sidelines, and you're going to want to know why. Later on in the program, Frank Holmes will be joining me as we talk about the breakout in gold. What's driving it? For almost 6 years, gold went nowhere. Now it's breaking out to new highs, and Frank thinks it's going much, much higher, taking out the old highs of the past. And, of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets, and then Chris Prytower and myself, we're going to talk about paradigm shift, where the next decade is going to be totally different. This was a decade where stocks and bonds did well. We don't think that's what's going to happen in the next decade. All of that coming up on today's program.
And now we welcome Ryan Poplava, CEO of Financial Sense Wealth Management. Ryan, tell us what moved the markets this week.
Well, Chris, I think this week's biggest catalysts were some geopolitical uncertainty in Hong Kong, Argentina, and Italy in the early parts of the week. Some growth concerns slapped the market in the face after a rally attempt, and then declining treasury yields kind of signaling a possibly recession down the road. That gave some signals to liquidate some equities. And then, of course, there's always some trade news. So let's kick things off. Let's start off looking at the geopolitical uncertainties. There was Hong Kong-related concerns. Essentially, if you've looked at the protests that are going on there, if you haven't been following it, there's an extradition bill that's been proposed by the government that would allow local authorities to extradite people wanted in territories Hong Kong currently doesn't have agreements with to extradite. So that would include China and Taiwan. Protesters were basically looking at this as a situation where if this bill goes through, that the Chinese would have more jurisdiction and more control, and they don't want that. Protesters took over Hong Kong International Airport, and for 2 days, there was just chaos between the police and protesters. And then, of course, there was the Chinese military just sitting outside on the border ready to intervene. And the Chinese saying, you know, we're not going to just sit on our hands. So everyone remembers Tiananmen Square and the concerns there. So, you know, that was what was affecting the markets at that point. But eventually, the airport did reopen. Control was found after the protesters had dispersed. And, you know, they handle over 1,000 flights per day. That's, you know, a lot of business that was kind of being held up. Looking at Italy, it's expected Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini's party will bring a no-confidence motion against Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte soon, which adds uncertainty on top of an already very sharp decline in their growth for the country. And that's, you know, obviously some concerns there. Moving on to Argentina, results came in from the primary elections, which showed left-wing candidate Alberto Fernandez led by a wide margin. And that sent the Argentino peso lower and stocks just crumbling. I think I was just taking a look at the Global X MSCI Argentina ETF. I think that symbol is ARGT. And that fell like 25% at one point this week. Stocks then, Chris, rallied strongly on Tuesday as a result of the White House dialing back on its tariff announcement, saying that the 10% tariff on goods scheduled to go into effect on September 1st would be pushed back. So that's being pushed back now to December. Not for everything. You know, there's some things that are going to go into effect on that September 1st, but many of the consumer electronic goods, such as phones, laptops, and more, Trump said, You know, he wanted to allow those to slip through with the holiday buying season coming through and those being heavy sellers, and essentially just giving China a little bit more time to kind of come to the table and have more discussions, which they said they're going to do. China's Ministry of Commerce stated that they would resume trade talks over phone in the next 2 weeks. So those were hopeful headlines, Chris, that rallied the S&P 500 close to its, actually closed above its 50-day moving average. But selling kind of resumed Wednesday when growth concerns hit the market tape. I mean, we're looking at China reported its slowest industrial production growth since 2002. Germany reported a negative 0.1% quarter over quarter decline for its GDP in the second quarter. So deep concerns there over growth, sending the market lower, sending yields falling. Gold futures closed at 1 point above 1527 on Wednesday. But the biggest news was the 10-year treasury yield falling below the 10-year falling below the 2-year treasury yield for the first time since 2007. Now, that seemed to put just undue pressure on equities, even though equities had rallied substantially the day before on what was essentially only a 1 basis point spread between the 2-year treasury and the 10-year treasury. So let's say the yield curve between the 2-year and the 10-year fully inverts. On average, the length of time it takes before the start of a recession since 1980 was right around 18 months. So it's not saying a recession's right around the very, very corner. It's saying, hey, there's some growth concerns globally, and that was spilling into our U.S. treasuries, and it's going to continue to spill over into our treasuries as you see negative rates overseas. Broad-based selling Wednesday sent the S&P 500 down 2.9%, the NASDAQ down 3%, and the Dow Industrials down 3.1%. What perhaps, Chris, reversed that 2-year 10 spread back to positive Thursday was retail sales. Retail sales were increased about 0.7% for July, even though industrial production declined 0.2%. Of course, our economy, 70% more in consumption. So this was really good news. And we finished the week on a positive note from NVIDIA's earnings, which supported growth and a tone that the market really could get behind in the informational technology sector, which led the advance from really oversold conditions previously.
Well, China tariffs, Hong Kong, the yield curve, all things contributing to volatility. Ryan, thank you for being in the studio today, and we'll look forward to hearing from you next week. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
If you look at the manufacturing sector of the world, globally and in the U.S., clearly there's a more pronounced slowdown. And one could argue that Europe is already in a virtual recession in terms of the manufacturing sector. It may not feel that way for the entire economy over there because their service sector is still expanding. The consumer is still healthy. Their job openings are actually still quite strong. That's a common factor throughout the world. In Japan, Europe, Germany, in the U.S., that there still is a bifurcation between manufacturing, the goods producing area of the economy, and the service sector, the consumer side of the economy.
Last year, interest rates were rising and the stock markets fell. Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered, no matter what direction the markets take. We can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, after languishing for almost 4 or 5 years, we now have gold becoming one of the top performing assets. And it's not just gold, it's sister metal. Silver is also rising along with the gold stocks. What's driving higher gold prices? Joining us on the program is Frank Holmes from U.S. Global. Frank, let's begin with gold. What is driving it? Is it negative interest rates? Is it trade wars? All of the above? Safety trade, fear trade, whatever you want to call it. But what's behind this move?
Well, one of the most steady things ever is the love trade. 60% of all demand for gold is for love. And it comes predominantly from where 40% of the world's population is, Chindia. And after you, it's China and India. And when you throw in the Middle East and Southeast Asia, we're talking about more than 50% of the world's population believe in gold as monetary asset, as love for their families, for weddings, for birthdays, for anniversaries, for graduation. It's gold, gold, gold. And so it's important to recognize this is an underpinning, an underbelly, and we've been along seeing a supply of gold from mines slow down till we have this thesis of peak gold. So there's no real great increase in amount of supply coming out for this continuous demand, which is highly correlated to GDP per capita. Now, the next big swing, which creates much more volatility, is the fear trade. It's about 40% of the equation, and that has these sort of short-term, where it's from 1 to 3 years that you get these incredible moves in gold. And I believe we're in that move now because the global economy started slowing down a year ago. I've been on your program several times, and I've talked about the importance of following Purchasing Manufacturers Index, the PMI, which is a great forecaster of commodity demand. And it's been negative for the past year. And then we had, within that, the trade war. And the trade war sort of exasperates it, because 40% of the world's population is China and India, and that really is correlated to consumption of products and services. And then we have to add on top of that is global trade is the U.S. and China. That's 40% of global trade, and they're in a spat. So you have a slowdown out of Europe, as a normal economic slowdown, and then you have a trade war. So then the world responds to that with negative real interest rates. That is, what governments will try to induce you to buy their bond after a CPI in Europe, you're losing money. In fact, it's so funny that in Denmark, they pay you to take out a mortgage. They pay you. So you're seeing that they're trying to stimulate it, and they're really broken. I was recently in Europe, and it's just incredible how complex. When we complain about taxation here, it's a nightmare there. And it's very, most of the people who try to get a job that are young, they've gone to England. And that's part of the repercussion of having Brexit. The taxation, the 25% every time you have a service tax, then you have to go back to get your money back. It's really cumbersome. So rather than deregulate, streamline taxation, streamline regulation, the EU just continues to say, oh, we'll just make, you know, negative interest rates. Well, no one's buying their bonds but themselves. So they're printing $1 trillion of funny money. And I think that is the real significant factor. And now we're seeing the U.S., it's not so much that they're doing currency manipulation, they just have negative real interest rates. So naturally, the euro has to fall, the Japanese yen has to fall, and the U.S. basically had high real interest rates. Well, now we're going negative. And since we're a third of the world's economy, guess what? Gold starts taking off in U.S. dollar terms, and it has this rippling effect around the world. So now gold is surging in most countries countries' currencies in the world.
You know, Frank, something that we don't see as much over here, I mean, people are complaining about low interest rates. The day you and I are doing this interview, yield on the 10-year note is below 1.6%. But as you mentioned, when you go to Europe, yields on Swiss bonds are negative 1%. There are negative 0.6% in Germany. And I don't know about you, Frank, I have never seen anything like this in my entire career. I mean, I've seen low interest rates, but not negative interest rates, where you've got almost a third of all sovereign debt that's negative. That has got to be positive for gold.
Very positive. And I think the U.S. is going to end up falling again. More rates are going to go lower, because now we have an inverted yield curve, and the market is just unraveling here on the fear of this inverted yield curve as a precursor to inflation, to a recession. And they're going to try to stop that. And I think that to prevent that recession, any time you've had still an expanding economy and you drop interest rates, odds favor when we get through this August, the market's going to be up in 6 months. So this is probably going to be a great buy here with this panic sell-off. And gold, it's going to continue to become that darling asset class.
You know, there is talk now, we've talked about the Fed cutting interest rates, but now there's a couple smart people that are talking about the U.S. could get back down to zero, or even the possibility that interest rates could go negative here if we do get into a recession. Do you buy into that?
Well, they could go negative if inflation pops its head, so rates go lower, it's a two-part curve. You know what? In Europe, they are basically flat. There's no money on your money. So here you're at least making a 160. I don't see 10-year bonds going to zero. I see them going down to 50 basis points, say 100 basis points even, and then you're going to have a negative real rate of return. Now, when gold hit 1900, the 10-year government bond was minus 300 basis points. And then the inflation came down and changed in the economy, and we went to only a plus 200 basis points. We had a 500 basis point swing, and that's when gold fell to 1,000. We're now going back the other way.
So, Frank, in this kind of market, if we do indeed get down to a 0.5% on the 10-year note, what do investors do for money? I mean, you can go into gold, but I know you wouldn't recommend people put 100% of their money in gold. What are people going to do for income?
Well, you know, the best performing asset class in the past 20 years has been REITs. Second has been bullion. So you look at the Ray Dalio's of the world, who run the largest hedge fund in the world, and he has a belief in 6 to 10% weighting in gold. And so I think that gold is going to be an important asset class and maintain that. But I think that people are going to go into REITs, or they're going into specialty bonds or unrated munis. That's where you're going to see where money has been going in this sort of flight to capital. One of our favorite in our funds is the Grand Columbia Gold Notes that are listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And they pay monthly, and they're 8.25%.
Wow.
And so it's backed by gold. It's a company has no debt except for the gold notes, and they're redeeming them from their production. They have $70 million in the bank. It's a profitable, high-grade operation. But I love those gold notes, and we have them in our funds for that reason.
So, Frank, in this kind of environment where we've got globally negative interest rates are heading down lower here, it seems to me, as you mentioned, it's going to chase money out into other investments in search of yield. So, as you mentioned, REITs have been one of the best performers this year. You've got the utility index, which is outperforming, consumer staples, which is outperforming. So people are going to search wherever they can get a good return on their market, and certainly gold is going to be one of them. Now, let me talk about some of the other metals. Up until recently, silver has been underperforming, but now it seems to be playing catch-up. We've got the gold stocks also confirming gold's move. So let's talk about silver and the gold stocks themselves.
Well, silver, you know, silver is poor man's gold, as they like to call it, and it has sort of a leverage factor to it. I've always looked at it as a financial product, and that is it's much more industrial-based than it is precious, and it has a lot to do with the technology and health and healthcare. Silver plating of things, viruses can attach themselves to it. So I've sort of looked at it that in that capacity. But what happens is that when you get a certain move in gold, you usually get a 50% move in percentage terms greater in silver, both up and down. And so that whipsaw that's taking place on the upside is silver's catching up, and silver will probably trade higher. So in every bull cycle we've seen, silver, if gold is up 15%, silver's up 20%.
Let's talk also about the stocks, because quite honestly, the stocks have not been a great asset class to be in. A lot of these mining companies have not been able to increase their production. So you see, you know, the big guys buying other companies, whether they're buying Goldcorp, Rand Gold. I want to talk about the stocks themselves. And generally, if gold goes up, they usually go up 2 to 3 times the price of gold. Do you see that continuing?
Well, it's a great question. On your program, I've always advocated royalty companies. And since 2008, when Franco-Nevada went public again, it's far outperformed any of the gold stocks. And so when we look at royalty companies, they have a superior business model. And so I think when one wants to take a look, there are a lot of non-gold-oriented people buy from a financial point of view. So what would you prefer to have? You own Barrick and you own Newmont, and they're big producers out of Nevada. And the average revenue per employee is $600,000. But if you own Franco-Nevada, the revenue is $21 million in revenue per employee. So it's much higher. It's much more efficient use of capital. If you look at any sector of the economy, there's 11 sectors, those that have the highest revenue per share, called the efficiency ratio, historically just can weather any downdrafts better. And that's what the model of the royalty companies have been able to do. So I think from that end, your comments are right about the many of the mid-cap and big-cap gold stocks, because they've made terrible acquisitions. And that was another reason why I launched GoAU, the sort of smart, intelligent way of a small basket of gold stocks. ETF. And then when we backtested the thought process, it outperformed the GDXJ 90%, more than 90% of the time in rolling 12-month periods. And since we launched it 2 years ago, it's outperformed it by 16%. And year to date, it's outperformed it by 10%. So the idea of focusing on the important parts of a company, such as revenue per share, cash flow per share, highest returns on invested capital. If you buy things on sale, they've got to have the lowest cash flow to enterprise value. When you create a recipe like that, like making cake, you truly have the best cake mix out there. And that's why it's done that. So I think there's lots of opportunity in gold stocks, but you have to be, and it's really a small number of the 88 global gold producers. If you focus on the top 10 to top, and we have 28 names, three of them are royalty companies. They're 30% of the portfolio, 10% each. They rebalance each quarter. The rest are looking for those companies that are really protecting what you and I want is the value metrics per share. And it outperforms. So I think that's how you have to be very selective on this cycle for picking gold stocks. Now, the speculative money hasn't come in, even though we've had a $200 move in the price of gold. Speculative money, when you look at the small caps, our World Precious Minerals has far underperformed the bigger cap gold stocks because there's a big weighting in these juniors, micros. Money's still not coming in there yet.
So, Frank, your gold fund that you launched is smoking the competition. Has it been mainly because of the weighting you've had in the royalty companies and then this handful of select companies that have good metrics compared to just, say, buying a wide swath or basket of miners?
Well, it's a combination of both, but I really think it's because it's only 2 years that it's been public to demonstrate that. It's the sort of the quantamental approach to picking stocks. So here's a classic error that takes place by analysts that sell you gold stocks out there. They have, well, the NAV, the net asset value of company A is cheaper than company B. But broker A versus B all have different ways of valuing NAV. So there's no consistent NAV. So it really doesn't help you make, you know, good decisions. And companies publish their all-in costs. They're all different what they define all-in costs are. So you really can't do relative comparisons on a good basis. So you have to look at the revenue per share, the reserves per share, everything on a per share metric. And that way you can pick a basket of gold stocks. Our biggest turnover, you know when it happened?
When?
Our biggest turnover last September when Vanguard got out at the very bottom. They blew out, they changed their name of their gold fund to a resource fund, and they got a new manager, and they blew out all their gold stocks. Well, so many of these great gold stocks got sold way, way cheap, and that triggered our model to say, sell this, buy this, because it's so much cheaper. And that's what really helped us, that sort of turnover. Otherwise, since that date, it's been pretty consistent, low turnover in picking stocks.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, as we close, if our listeners want to find out more about the funds that you run at U.S. Gold, how can they do so?
USFunds.com, USFUNDS.com. As you know, I publish every week the Investor Alert, and I have about 50,000 weekly readers in 180 countries, so they can get an idea of what we feel when we talk about PMI, Purchasing Manufacturers Index, or other factors that can impact the price of gold or economy. Do call up and subscribe. And Go Gold is listed on New York Stock Exchange. The ticker is GOAU.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
All right. Happy investing.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The situation now is that very few Mexicans migrate to the United States. It's net zero on its migration. The economy in Mexico is too good to leave behind. What the people who are coming to the United States are from Central America, from Guatemala, from Honduras, from Salvador. And they come to Mexico. The Mexican police arrest them if they find them along the border. When they don't, they allow them to pass to go through Mexico to go to the United States. So the problem that we have here is an interesting one, because the Mexicans are as hostile to Central American migration as the United States. They try to keep them out, and then they pass them up to the border. Now, one of the things both sides realize is this issue has got to be kept separate from trade. Both the United States and Mexico need each other much too much.
Well, talk about trade has had the market given it ups and downs this week. Is this serious? A minor correction? Where do we go from here? Joining us from Stock Charts is Art Hill. And Art, I want to talk about a piece that you published on Thursday. As you took a look at the S&P 500, the different sectors within it. Now, when I look at your table, it's clear energy is negative across all of your breath signals. But also on the positive side is healthcare, utilities, real estate, and they seem to be more in staples. These seem to be more defensive sectors. So let's talk about your table and what's going on within the S&P.
Okay. Yes, Jim, it's good to be here. I've got a what I call a sector breadth model, and it's based on the 11 sectors in the S&P 500. And I'm looking at three breadth indicators to try and get a weight of the evidence. So that's 11 sectors, three breadth indicators. So you have a total of 33 indicators. And I also apply the weights of the sector to these indicator signals. So technology is 22% of the S&P 500. So its signal is going to carry more weight than, say, materials, which is just 2.74% of the S&P 500. So we're looking for three things. We're looking for a breadth thrust, which is like a 10-day EMA of advanced decline percent. And when you get one of those, that's usually the early warning kind of signal. The second one's high-low percent, which is new highs minus new lows divided by total issues. And it tells you how many stocks as a percentage of the total stocks in that sector are in strong uptrends or in strong downtrends. And then the other one is the percentage of stocks above the 200-day EMA, which just gives you an idea of how many or what percentage of stocks are in uptrends or downtrends in that sector. And so when I calculate these every week, we do this at Stock Charts. You can view these indicators there. But what I do is I put them in a table every week and I look for the signals. And when two of the three turn bullish, I'm bullish. When two of the three turn bearish, I'm bearish. And right now, the utilities, consumer staples, and real estate sectors are still bullish, and so is healthcare. But if you look at the healthcare chart, the XLV chart, it's gone nowhere for over a year. So it's kind of in a no man's land. But you're right, REITs, utilities, and staples still have strong charts.
But Art, doesn't it tell you that investors as a whole are playing this defensive? Is that part of it? Or do you think part of it could also be a yield play with the 10-year getting down to about 1.5%? Investors are scrambling for yields, and these are three sectors that are not only defensive, but they also carry high dividend yields.
Sure, and real estate and REITs and utilities are kind of like the bond proxies. So when bonds go up, they tend to be positively correlated to bonds and negatively correlated to interest rates. So they're benefiting from that dynamic. And on the other side of that coin, you have the finance sector. And banks are they're seriously underperforming. If you look at the KBE, the banking SBDR, and you look at the KRE, the regional banking SBDR, they are two of the weakest industry groups out there, and they are weighing on the finance sector. And that could be because of interest rates moving lower and also with this semi-inversion of the yield curve. I don't think the 2-10's quite inverted yet, but you know, banks, you know, they borrow short and they lend long. And when the yield curve is as flat as it is, it's hard to make money.
I want to talk about two sectors that are negative, and usually you wouldn't see this, and that is energy, which is negative across all your breath signals, and then also consumer discretionary. Usually when energy prices are low or gasoline prices are coming down, it's usually kind of like a tax cut for consumers. So you've got consumer discretionary negative across the board too.
I do. And if you look at the chart for XLY, it doesn't reflect that negativity within the sector. If you look at the chart for, say, XRT, the retail SBDR, it is one of the weakest industry groups out there. It's like the bank SBDR, very weak. But the XLY, the consumer discretionary SPDR, is being held up by the likes of Amazon and McDonald's and Home Depot. But what I'm seeing here, though, is I think energy is just hitting kind of like that perfect storm. You know, first there was this overproduction and overexploration and the fracking, and so we had too much supply coming on. And now we also have the green movement and the move to alternatives, electric cars, for example. And so that is hurting the energy sector. So I think they're almost two separate dynamics at this stage in the fact that energy is getting hit for different reasons. And yeah, consumer discretionary, it's internally very weak, but the XLY is still holding up. It kind of looks the same as the XLK chart, the technology SPDR chart, which is holding up too.
Yeah, it seems like energy is currently out of favor. I was looking at some fundamental data. Energy demand was up 3% last year since hitting a bottom in 2016. The price of oil is up 110%, but energy stocks are only up about 15%. So it's clearly a sector that's out of favor. I want to talk about something one of your founders has often talked about, and that is intermarket analysis. In his book, Intermarket Analysis, John Murphy talked about usually in a bear market, you see bonds peak first, then it's stocks, and then it's commodities. That doesn't seem to be working right now. I'd like to get your comment on that. What's going on here?
Well, I guess there are different types of bear markets. You know, in 2008, of course, that was the financial crisis, and oil continued up the first 6 months of 2008 and then peaked much later than the stock market. And interest rates moved down, so bonds moved up, and then interest rates moved sharply lower at the end. But I think what John might be alluding to is we may be making that shift from the inflationary environment where investors are basing their decisions on an inflationary overall macro environment to perhaps a deflationary environment. And that would change the relationship between stocks and bonds and stocks and commodities.
Let's talk about something. And speaking of commodities, one commodity that's doing very well right now, let's talk about gold. I mean, it seems like everything's going for it. You have silver going up with gold. You have the GDX, the gold stocks confirming. So it looks like this is a powerful trend here with the breakout.
Yeah, gold is definitely in a powerful trend. It's so powerful. I had to put on the longer term weekly charts to get an idea of what's going on. But clearly you can see a big resistance level there in that 1350 area that was just broken like a hot knife through butter in June with that big breakout. The only negative I see on gold is that it is quite extended because it has had a pretty sharp move just the last 4 weeks. You know, it's up 8% over the last 4 weeks. So the last signal was kind of a consolidation that we had into July. And then in the late July, we got a consolidation breakout. So I think now it's just time to watch and wait for the next bullish setup to appear. You might turn to the daily charts for a bullish setup.
I want to go back to the S&P and let's talk about where you think the market might be heading here, in, especially as we head into the volatile August-September period. It always seems that I call it hurricane season for the stock market. But you look at some of your sectors, you have consumer services, that's not looking too good, finance not looking too good, consumer discretionary not looking too good, industrials not looking good, and energy not looking good. What really looks good, as we've been talking about here, are the bond proxies and the defensive sector of the market.
Yeah, and it's a bit strange, but technology is holding up. You still look at that XLK chart. And sure, it had a decline in August, but it's still well above that early June low, and it's well above its rising 200-day. Now, what I see here is you got that big decline, and now we've had a bit of a consolidation the last week and a half or so. So maybe it's a little triangle, and watch out, if you break below this week's low, then that would signal a continuation lower and target a move to the 200-day for the technology sector. And as the biggest sector, that would clearly weigh on the S&P 500. That would show that this bear market environment, which I think we are in right now. Because as you said, when you look at financials and industrials and consumer discretionary, and if they're in bear market mode, as they are on the breadth table that I've got, you throw in communication services, which just flipped this week as well. That's four of the five offensive sectors. The only one left is technology. So I think the market is looking pretty vulnerable at this stage.
Let's talk about bonds here for a second, because we're not quite inverted between the 2 and the 10. It did briefly, momentarily this week. But as you look at interest rates, who would have thought, you know, in 2016, when we got down into the 1.3, now there's people talking about, we could go below 1%, and even some experts saying we could go negative, much like Europe.
Yeah, it's crazy when you look at some of these European yields that are in negative territory in Germany and in Switzerland. Right now, the 10-year's at around 1.5%. So, you know, we do have quite a ways to go before we can think about negative interest rates. But just the magnitude of the move, the 10-year has been cut in half in less than 1 year. It's gone from 3.2% to 1.5%. And that's clearly also signaling a flight to safety. The treasury yield is falling because investors, traders are buying treasury bonds. And so that means money that's going into treasury bonds is money that's not available for other areas such as the stock market.
You know, it's amazing. Most people don't realize that. I mean, we were towards the end of last year, we were at 3.25%. On the 10-year treasury. Now we're at 1.5. People have no idea when you have these big swings in interest rates, you can make as much money in long-term bonds as you can in stocks. I mean, you look at TLT, it was around 116. Today, it's around 145. I mean, that's a major move.
And, you know, TLT kind of lulled everybody to sleep because it was kind of flat from, you know, January 2015 until November, December 2018, and then it got this massive breakout and is up double digits, over 20% this year. So it just goes to show you, you know, you never know how far something will go. You just have to respect that trend until it gives you signals that it is reversing. But it's been a major, major move.
So in kind of summing up here, we've got bond proxies like REITs and utilities and even staples, very defensive, kind of correlated with the movement in interest rates, doing well. But as you mentioned, you've got four major sectors: financial, consumer discretionary, industrials. These things are heading or in bear market territory. As an investor, what do you do here, Art?
Well, as an investor, yeah, also, it always depends on your time horizon, but I put myself more in the market timing camp. And I have to say, does the risk justify the reward, the potential risk versus the potential reward? And when you see all these key sectors, as we talked about, breaking down and their breadth indicators turning net bearish, that tells you that internally, inside the market, the average stock is not doing that well. And that's within the S&P 500. I'm not even going to go into the Russell 2000, which is doing even worse. But within the S&P 500, I'm seeing a lot of weakness in key sectors, and that's got to be a concern. So I would be more on the sidelines right now, waiting for things to improve and some sort of a bullish signal to appear. I know the S&P is still above its 200-day, and the 50-day is above the 200-day. But if you look inside the S&P 500, it's telling you a different story. Now, I will note that I put out another piece on Thursday, and I was looking at correlations. And also the concern is, you know, when the market declines, and especially when the S&P 500 declines sharply, correlations tend to rise. So we do think of staples and utilities and REITs as defensive sectors. But if you just go back to that big decline we had before in January, utilities took a big hit and correlation rose. They became positively correlated with the S&P 500 all of a sudden in December. So did REITs and so did staples. So if the decline does extend, I'm afraid I would fear that correlations could rise and even these defensive sectors could get hit.
As we close, Art, why don't you tell people about stock charts? And I love your market summary page, where that's my go-to page in the morning. I can find out about markets, about sectors, about interest rates, international currency, commodities, and you've even improved it. and adding a chart as you go through these indexes. You can click on those charts right there. Tell our listeners about your website and especially my favorite page, the market summary.
Sure. We'll start with that market summary. So if you go to our website at the top, stockcharts.com, at the top left, you've got a charts and tools tab. And if you click on that tab, you're going to see all the tools that you have available here at Stock Charts. There are free tools. Everything is available for free on a limited basis. And then some of the more advanced features are, of course, for subscribers. But on the right-hand side, you can scroll down and there'll be a navigation and you can see the summary pages. And there is the market summary. And it gives you basically a great overview of what's happening in the market. And it is updated intraday. So you can see real time, almost 15-minute delay, 20-minute delay, what's happening. And there's a little chart on the left-hand side that you can hover over the symbol and see the chart without moving on that page. It just shows the chart just to the left. So you got major markets, then you got the sectors, and you can scroll through all 11 sectors in less than a minute if you want and see all those charts. You got the industry groups, you got the international, the bonds, the commodities, the currencies, and market breadth. And we also have a lot of good commentary here at Stock Charts, of course. There's an articles tab at the top where you can read the latest from John Murphy. I produce something called Arts Charts, and there is a tab there or a link there for that, where you can read about the sector breadth model and the index breadth model, which just switched. They were bullish in mid-February, and they switched back to bearish this week. So I'll be following that signal as it evolves.
All right, Art, thanks so much for joining us. You have a great weekend and the rest of the summer, and hope to talk to you again soon.
You bet, Jim. Always a pleasure, and have a great weekend.
Now, the title of the big picture this week is Paradigm Shift, the Return of Financial Repression and Asset Shifts. Now, in business and economics, the phrase the new normal often refers to something abnormal that becomes commonplace. And in economics or in financial history, we've seen it applied following the financial crisis of 2007 to 2008 and the aftermath of the 08 to 2012 global recession. Now, Jim, we're seeing a new normal right now. How would you describe it today, and what do you think makes it different from before?
Well, the term first became popular with PIMCO after the financial crisis. And Chris, it was a term used to describe the unusually low interest rates when the Fed funds rate got to zero. And really, the new normal goes back to even Greenspan in the bursting of the tech bubble, because typically, for almost half a century, the Fed, if they wanted to tighten conditions, they would raise the Fed funds rate to 5, 6, even as high as 7%. The economy would go into recession. They would drop it down to 3. And that was pretty much the way it looked for almost half a century. Well, in the 2001 recession, Greenspan brought the Fed funds rate down to 1%, and Bernanke brought it all the way down to 0. So the new normal was an expression used to describe 0% interest rates, the anemic economic growth, and the burgeoning deficits. So you got to remember, going back to 2009 and 2010, we were looking at $1.6 trillion deficits. So that is what has been described as the new normal. But, you know, it goes beyond that. And here's the significance of it. And we're going to put this chart up on our website. We have a graph of interest rates that go back to 3000 BC, all the way back to the time of King Hammurabi. And at that time, the interest rates were 20%, and those were usually on loans from silver. And we got almost to that level in the late 70s, when 10-year treasuries got up to almost 16%. But here's the point. Throughout human history, average interest rates have been between 3 and 6%. And we got down to zero, and now, for the first time in history, nearly one-third of all sovereign debt is negative. And let me give you an example of this, of how bad this is for savers and investors. If you look at Switzerland, the interest rate is over a negative 1%. If you look at Sweden, over close to 1%. If you look at Japan, negative interest rates there, The Japanese is negative. Let me see. It's probably about almost 25 basis points that are negative. If you look at Germany, negative by 0.7%. The ECB funds rate is a negative 4, and they're talking about lowering it. So it's not just the fact that we're seeing the lowest interest rates. We are also seeing negative interest rates for the first time in human history.
Well, Jim, you mentioned the countries that are experiencing negative rates, and might I add that four other banks cut their rates last week: New Zealand, India, Thailand, and the Philippines. So I'm really curious about the impact that central banks, their ability to ward off the next recession, because in the past, many recessions have been traced to high interest rates that were instituted by the Fed. So how do you see these central banks being able to ward off another recession?
You know, they're going to have a little bit more difficulty, and the efficacy of monetary policy is having less and less of effect. And the reason, Chris, there's an awful lot of debt out there. If you're up to debt up to your eyeballs, there's only so much lower interest rates can do. And also, if you don't have a lot of confidence, which is one of the problems with businesses right now, because global supply chains, and we'll get to this in a bit, are being reconfigured as a result of these tariffs and the trade war. So that is zapping business confidence. Well, if you aren't confident about your sales, about the future, it doesn't matter what interest rates are, you're going to hold back. You're probably not going to go build a new plant. Maybe you might refinance if you have a higher interest rate. We could see that happen. But I think one of the things that they're talking about, the Fed is talking about a new tool that they would use in the next downturn, which would reduce the amount of capital that a bank would have to keep at the Fed. So in other words, by reducing that, the hope would be that the banks would take this excess capital and they would loan it out into the marketplace. But let me point out, there's two sides to that equation. You not only have to have a lender that is willing, you also have to have a borrower that's willing to accept and take on new risk and borrow money. And when confidence isn't there, that doesn't happen. So they're going to have less and less tools, I predict. We'll see what we've seen under Trump is, and this is what we're hearing a lot with modern monetary theory, it's going to be fiscal spending. In other words, how do you get money into the economy if people are reluctant to take on credit? The way you do that is through the government. The government goes into deficit spending. They spend the money, so the actual money gets into the economy, and then the Federal Reserve would just simply come in and monetize the debt. So that's more inflationary than what occurred under Bernanke, where they printed a bunch of money, but a lot of that money did not get extended as a form of credit into the economy. It remained on the balance sheet of the Fed. Another tool you might see them use is right now the Fed is paying money on reserves held at the Fed. They could actually get rid of the interest rate they pay and actually even go negative as they are in Europe, which means if you're a bank, why would you keep money at the Fed if the Fed was going to charge you interest? It's very much the same today that we're seeing in the bond market where there's negative interest rates on sovereign yields. And the reason is if you are, let's say, a large institution where you have to keep large amounts of capital that aren't insured, you wouldn't keep it at a bank. So your preference would be into sovereign debt. Who would ever loan money to a government if the government actually charges you interest? It's people that have large amounts of cash and they're looking for a safe place to keep it.
Well, it doesn't sound very safe if they're charging you to keep it. Well, I was reading an article by Mark Thornton. He's a senior fellow at the Mises Institute, and he gives a definition of financial repression that I think is appropriate here. And he dates the use of the term back to at least 1973, but he says it's comprised of two things: where the government takes wealth from the private sector and then makes it easier for the government to finance its debt. And the two things, the first one is zero interest rate policy, where many of the world's central banks keep their lending rates to banks at or near zero. And the second is quantitative easing, which is the central bank policy of buying up government debt from banks. Now, Thornton asserts that the fallout of this is that you're hurting the insurance industry, you're hurting homes, health, and property, but he says the economic beneficiaries include the big banks, Wall Street, the national government itself, and certain large corporations. Jim, do you think he's identified the definition correctly?
Yeah, he has. And he points out this actually occurred after World War II, when the debt-to-GDP ratio was the highest that we had seen. So how did we get rid of this debt? We basically inflated it away, and also we kept the Fed, by buying and financing the government's deficits and monetizing it, kept interest rates artificially low, which is what we've seen in this decade. I mean, up until, what was it, 2015, the Fed raised interest rates for the first time. They only raised it a quarter of a point. They only raised it another quarter of a point in 2016. So it took them almost 3 years to go from 0 to 2.5%. And I guarantee you, they'll go lower much faster. It's not going to take 2.5 years to bring the interest rates down to zero. But the reason that they're going to more likely do this, Chris, is when the debt is as large as it is today. Remember, we're approaching now $23 trillion. The budget deficit this year is going to be $1 trillion, and we are in a growing economy with the lowest unemployment in half a century, and we're running $1 trillion deficits. In the next decade, we're probably going to be running $2 trillion or more as more baby boomers tap into Medicare and Social Security entitlements and all those things, plus interest on the debt. And the other way to keep the debt manageable for the government is to keep interest rates artificially low. Because imagine right now the government pays a little over 2% on all of its debt, if you take the average. Imagine what would happen if interest rates went from 2% to 4%. The government would end up paying almost $1 trillion a year in interest. So this is what we're transitioning to in what I call a new paradigm shift. And we're going to talk about Ray Dalio's piece. It was something we first brought up on this program, I think a little over a year ago. We did a program on what the next decade is going to look like. And it's going to be a decade where fiscal policy is going to be used more and more to keep the economy running. And to finance those huge deficits, you're going to see the Fed monetize that debt.
And one of the things I've heard you say in the past, Jim, is that the consequence of negative interest rates and financial repression, it's basically a tax on savers, that the biggest losers are seniors. Now, that certainly can't go over well, particularly in an election cycle. It begs the question, if the Fed is firing bullets now, what's next when actual trouble does arrive? I mean, the president just recently on Wednesday said that the central bank acted, quote, far too quickly, end quote, on raising rates. And then that was a tweet. And then 2 hours later, President Trump said that Fed Chairman Jerome Powell was making, quote, enormous mistakes. So the stakes are definitely high, and many experts are predicting that U.S. interest rates could head below 1%, some say negative, which is what we've been talking about. In fact, John Roque on last week's Financial Sense NewsHour was saying that he believes that domestic rates could become negative. What's your thinking on that? Do you agree with Roque?
If we get into a severe recession, absolutely. I mean, the Fed funds rate is roughly around 2 to 2.25%. And we're talking about more rate hikes coming this year, one maybe in September, another possible one in December. So what are they going to do? I mean, they'll bring interest rates down to zero. They may lower capital requirements at banks. But really, Chris, it's going to take fiscal stimulus to get the economy restarted again. The problem that the Fed has right now, and this is the problem the president has, is the dollar has been appreciating over the last 2 years against major currencies. And we are, as we did last week on the program, we're involved in a full-scale currency war right now. No country wants a strong currency. What is making the dollar stronger is our economy is growing at a faster rate than most developed countries. I mean, Germany just had a negative print on second quarter GDP. Europe is in the doldrums. Japan is in the doldrums. The U.S. economy, it's not humming along, but I mean, it's growing at close to 2%. Unemployment is the lowest in half a century. And our interest rates, Chris, look like junk bonds. I mean, why would you want to put money in a Swiss government bond for 10 years or Sweden and pay a negative 1% interest? In other words, you're paying the government to loan them money compared to the U.S. Treasury, even on this day, U.S. Treasuries are now below 1.5%, but they're at 1.5%. That's positive, and that's 2.5% larger than what you can get in Sweden. Let's say Switzerland, almost 2.25% higher than what you can get in Germany. So that is keeping the dollar strong. So Trump is saying, look, the ECB is talking about cutting rates. Other countries are cutting rates, which is making our dollar stronger. Why are you keeping interest rates this high? Because money is flowing into the United States for two reasons. Safe haven, higher interest rates, most liquid market in the world. And that's basically what is hurting a lot of these corporate earnings. Many of the companies that missed second quarter earnings talked about a higher dollar basically ate into their profit margins.
Well, last year, the markets worried over rising interest rates. Now it's the trade war, clearly. But also, you just mentioned what's happening overseas with Germany, Japan, even France. We've also got an inverted yield curve. It seems like all of this is ramping up pressure on the Fed Reserve to cut rates for the second time in September. So all of that taken into account, and in fact, did you read, Jim? I was looking at mortgage debt has hit a record. It surpassed the high from 2008 at $9.294 trillion. Do you see, I'm just looking at everything combined, the inverted yield curve, everything that's happening with negative rates globally, how does this get resolved? And when does mortgage debt and debt levels at the corporate level, when does all of that become a problem?
It becomes a problem when you have some kind of triggering event, maybe a hedge fund goes under, a financial institution, and psychology and confidence is lost. And confidence, I can't overemphasize this, is very important here. And I want to go back to the financial crisis in 2008 when Lehman went under, and everybody remembers the Hank Paulson press conferences every Monday. People lost confidence in government. And once that confidence is lost, it's very hard to regain. It almost took 9 months before they could turn it around. They did it with QE. They did it with the stimulus program. A new administration, the Obama administration, replaced Bush. The Fed launched QE. Obama had a $1 trillion stimulus package. So there's two things where psychology plays a role. It plays a role when it comes to panic in the markets. When people lose confidence in the markets, then it's a full-scale panic. People can lose confidence in inflation. Inflation is every bit as much psychological as it is fundamental. And then the other thing is when it comes to the economy, if people lose confidence and they start getting scared, what do? They pull back on spending. They're saying, boy, I don't know what the future looks like. I'm going to postpone purchases. They hold, they postpone, they start saving, and it becomes self-fulfilling. So there is a very delicate balance here that the president needs to walk, as well as the Fed, is to keep public confidence. Because on the day you and I are doing this broadcast, Walmart reported sales. They beat estimates. According to Walmart, the average Joe is doing pretty good right now because we are looking at wages rising, low unemployment. But it's important because on the business side of things, business investment is down, business confidence is down. And that is important. If we have a recession, Chris, it's going to be led by investment. It's not going to be the consumer. Right now, things are looking pretty good for the consumer. Take a look at what's happened to the cost of housing. It's gone up. So that debt measured against higher housing prices doesn't look as bad on the surface because obviously the value of the asset, the underlying asset, the home, is gone up. So it's very important here that we maintain consumer confidence. And I just don't know how much longer this trade war is going to go. I suspect as we get towards the end of the year, Trump made his fortune in real estate. He knows that come November of 2020, if this economy is in a recession or we have a bear market, his presidency is over.
Well, and I appreciate the balance you're bringing to the topic, Jim. And in fact, former Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen even was quoted as saying that she thinks the U.S. economy has enough strength to avoid a recession. Still, I'm glad we are covering the risks out there just so that our listeners are, in fact, informed. And to that end, you did identify three major risks over the last 2 years. The first one was an index fund bubble. The second was financial concentration, and the third was liquidity constraints. Given those three risks, where do you think all this is headed?
You know, I think eventually we will get a recession. It'll probably be led by business, not the consumer. And then I think we'll get a bear market, and the government response this time will be heavy fiscal spending. The Fed will monetize debt, interest rates will be at zero, and you're going to see an asset shift, because eventually the way you get rid of debt is you inflate it away. And right now, as we covered last week, we're in the middle of a currency war. Nobody wants a strong currency, and that is more so overseas. The U.S. is less dependent on exports than, let's say, Europe or Asia. But eventually, Chris, you're going to see devaluations. And when interest rates get to zero, or in fact, if they get down to negative interest rates, as we're seeing throughout parts of Asia and throughout Europe, who is going to want to keep their money in cash? You're going to get penalized. UBS just announced that they are going to be charging their large depositors an interest rate. In other words, a penalty. And I saw this, Chris, in the 70s when I was just getting into the business in the late 70s. The dollar was devalued. It was depreciating. Inflation rates were at 15%. And money was gravitating towards the Deutschmark and the Swiss franc were the strongest currencies. To discourage a rising currency, Switzerland actually charged depositors an interest rate. And we're going to see that in the next downturn. You could very well see banks charge large depositors a negative interest rate, meaning it'll cost you money to keep your money at the bank. And so, and I think that is going to trigger a paradigm shift, and it's going to be into real assets. We're very bullish on gold, very bullish on where I think oil is. I think people are misreading on what's really occurring in oil. Demand is still growing, and also the growth rate in the Permian Basin is starting to slow down. This will probably be the last year you're going to see upwards of, let's say, 1 million barrels of increased production. I think you'll see production increase, but it's going to drop down to maybe 200,000 or 300,000 barrels. Right now, there's a big story that they think there's going to be an oil glut in 2020. At least right now, on the real fundamentals that we're watching, we just don't see it. But I think the big thing you're going to see in the next decade, you're going to see financial repression, interest rates kept artificially low, if not negative. You're going to see large, massive deficits in the neighborhood of probably $2 trillion or more. You're going to see Fed monetizing debt, and all of that is going to cause a major asset shift. I mean, just think of this new century. In the last decade, it was a terrible decade for stocks and bonds. You made your money in real assets, real estate, gold, silver, oil, commodities. Fast forward to this decade, just the opposite. The money was not made in commodities, gold, or oil. The money was made in financial assets like stocks and bonds. I see that reversing in the next decade.
Speaking of a paradigm shift, you mentioned at the beginning of this recording for The Big Picture, the name Ray Dalio, the hedge fund investor. He has over 50 years experience as a global macro investor, and he published an essay called Paradigm Shifts. And I just want to quote a couple of sentences from this, Jim, and see if this is exactly what you're thinking. He writes that any one single approach to investing will experience a time when it performs so terribly that it can ruin you. He says the big question worth pondering at this time is which investments will perform well in a reflationary environment. And he says, toward the end of his essay, he says, I think that those that will most likely do best will be those that do well when the value of money is being depreciated and domestic and international conflicts are significant, such as gold.
I couldn't agree with him 100% more, because that's exactly what we see coming. In fact, I'm trying to think of the show that we did on that last year where we talked about this next shift of fiscal spending. And then basically the Fed's role is simply at that point going to be to come in, print the money, and monetize the debt. And that's where I think we're heading. We're heading towards devaluations. In fact, he comes and talks a little bit more not only about currency depreciations, fiscal deficits that are monetized, which I see happening. There's just no way that they can have the tax revenues to pay for all this. And he said at various points in history, the Federal Reserve has chosen sides. Sometimes when they're raising interest rates, they are helping creditors, and other times when they're keeping them artificially low, they're helping debtors. And what they're going to be doing, as they did in this last decade, and the same I think they're going to do in the next decade, is they're going to help and provide debt relief, not only to heavy debtors, whether it's corporations, individuals, but most importantly, government. And it's going to be a decade that's going to involve conflicts. You're seeing social unrest. He talks about how these paradigm shifts come. And, you know, if you think about it, you almost see these shifts, as Dalio talks about, occur just about every 10 years. And I really recommend, if you have the chance, read his piece, because it's very profound. And it's great that he is sharing this publicly today, because he's basically saying this is kind of a warning to everybody, because there's a tendency, Chris, and, you know, whether people do this, we do this in the financial markets, a trend that has been in place for a long period of time. Everybody thinks that, well, they just extend it forward. We've been in this paradigm for probably the last 10 years. Everybody thinks it'll happen the next 10 years. But that's not the case. The last decade, if you were in stocks and bonds, it was a terrible decade for stocks and bonds. Returns were awful. The real returns were in real assets. And that's what basically Dalio is saying here. The next decade, deficits, devaluations, financial repressions, social unrest, all of that adding up, it's going to be a return to real assets, because I just don't see people keeping money in the bank at negative interest rates. I mean, if you're a pension or institution like an insurance company, there's no way you're going to be able to do that. You won't be able to run your business.
So, Jim, to sum all of this up, you are seeing a major paradigm shift that's going to change everything as we see it, that's not going to be good for financial assets. Is that a safe way of putting it?
Yeah, I think pretty much next decade, it's going to be gold, it's going to be commodities, it's going to be real assets will be the performers, just as they were in the last decade, just as they were, for example, in the 70s. Because you can't have, Chris, devaluations, multi-trillion dollar deficits, Fed monetization, negative interest rates. That is not a climate in social unrest. That's not a climate. I think we've reached the peak in corporate profit margins, and I see the next decade as one of real assets.
That being said, Jim, what do you see coming up in the weeks ahead?
Coming up in the weeks ahead, well, we've got the Fed conclave at Jackson Hole. Everybody will be watching and seeing, kind of as we dissect every single word and parse it. What will the Fed do in September? Will it be a quarter point, half a point cut? Will they go again in December? So we have that coming up. We also have in the month of September, officials from China are meeting over this trade skirmish in Washington. So we have that to look forward to. So lots of stuff. And for whatever reason, usually August, September, first parts of October tend to be the most turbulent points of the year in the markets traditionally. And I think a lot of that, Chris, has to do with a lot of analysts, economists revise their estimates for the year. So if companies didn't meet their earnings in the first half, you're probably revising those earnings estimates by the time you get to Q3. And right now, they've been beating estimates, but year over year, actual earnings are down. So those are the things we'll be looking forward to. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.